Alex, what would the soundtrack to your life be? The Stones, the Beatles, or Aqua? Hi, this is Karan from San Francisco.
This is Alex from Los Angeles, and welcome to Movies That Shaped Us. We are two longtime friends who grew up on opposite ends of the globe with very different backgrounds, but we're both shaped and are still being shaped by the movies we see and love. In each episode, we'll cover a topic around important people, places, events, and moments in our lives, and then explore it through three of our favorite movies. So, Karan, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, we're talking about soundtracks, movies that shaped our love of film soundtracks. I mean, it's no secret, right? Like, the reason I and you love movies is because it's a multi-dimensional sensory medium of art and storytelling. And I think audio and hence music is a big part of that. And, you know, we did make an episode about a year or so ago on our favorite scores that have shaped our, you know, our love for film. So this is kind of a different take on that, which is soundtracks and how they've shaped our love of storytelling and movies. So Alex, do you want to maybe share a little bit about how you went about putting your list together?
Yeah. So I definitely echo, like, I love film soundtracks, not as much as film scores, but, you know, because they're different beasts for sure. Oh, another note we should probably just let our listeners know too. Like, we excluded musicals in terms of adaptations of Broadway musicals from this, because we felt that wasn't really film soundtracks. It was more Broadway. But yeah, like, I just thought back to, you know, the soundtracks I listened to the most, the soundtracks that I feel elevate movies in some way. I mean, there's so many directors that we'll get into some of them where just needle drops and where they put the music and which songs they use really add a lot of themes and layers and just make the movies better. So that is something I was thinking about a lot too. And then another thing beyond just listening to soundtracks, the ones that I like listening to a lot, you know, I think a great soundtrack can also, you know, introduce you to new types of music or put you, give you more appreciation for types of music that you already might've liked. And there really is an art to putting together a soundtrack that either the music supervisor's involved, sometimes the director's really heavily involved, sometimes even the screenwriter in a screenplay will say, this song is here. So it's just really interesting to think about all the ways that music, which I also love music can improve movies. It was a really fun, fun topic for me to think about. A lot of listening I was doing over the last couple weeks on these soundtracks.
Yeah, the same. And when I'm not listening to film scores driving around or walking around, I am listening to soundtracks for the most part. But yeah, I thought about my list in a very similar way of, you know, thinking about directors and stories and how they've used soundtracks to highlight and or underline different aspects of storytelling. But also in my life, the soundtracks that introduce me to different artists or genres of music. And I mean, this music is now a part of my life because of these movies, which is pretty amazing.
Totally. No, I think that's one of the big successes of a soundtrack that can get you going down a rabbit hole. Like, oh my gosh, who is this artist? Or what is this type of music? Because that's definitely happened to me. And I'll talk about one of those on my my list today. But there's several, you know, well, probably both of us will have a lot of films that didn't make the list because there's so many great soundtracks out there.
This was a very difficult episode to put together. I mean, as I would imagine, it's probably difficult for filmmakers to, you know, make the final choices of what's going to make into their movies.
Oh yeah.
Budget allowing.
Right. No,
that's
of course.
The other thing.
Yeah, that's a huge one. Right. No, there's a lot of famous stories of, you know, directors that have begging, you know, musicians. You know, I remember there was for The School of Rock, a movie we're not talking about today, but, you know, Jack Black had to send a video in begging Led Zeppelin to use a song because they don't use songs in movies. And they actually did allow it for that film because he you know, had this very impassioned video that he sent off to the band. So that stuff, I'm sure, happens all the time. It's definitely will be a fun list. I can't wait to jump into it.
All right. So what is your number three movie that shaped your love of soundtracks?
Sure. I'll drop the needle first then. And my number three is The Saint from 1997. This is a film directed by Philip Noyce, starring Val Kilmer and Elizabeth Shue. And the IMDb plot summary, Simon Templar, aka The Saint, is a thief for hire whose latest job to steal the secret process for cold fusion puts him at odds with a traitor bent on toppling the Russian government, as well as the woman who holds its secret. This movie is not a great movie. I'll admit that at the outset.
No, thank God.
It's a guilty pleasure for me, though. I will not defend the movie, but I love it. However, I wanted to start off my list with honoring a 90s soundtrack that meant a lot to me, but also I think this is an era of soundtracks that is gone. does not really exist anymore, of these big soundtracks with a lot of big artists. There's a big single on it. There were big selling soundtracks. And nowadays, I think really maybe streaming might have killed this, where there's no reason to compile together a soundtrack anymore because you can stream all the individual tracks that are available. Mm. So I wanted to make sure to talk about that. This is my 90s soundtrack on here. But also, I think that this is one of those soundtracks, like we were just talking about, that did get me interested in a whole type of music, electronic music, that I was not at all interested in at the time, and now is one of my favorite genres. And you know, most of the music I listen to is actually electronic music that I can trace back to this soundtrack. So just before I get more into the soundtrack and then a little more into the film, like, had you seen this movie before?
I'd seen this movie before, and or at least had like vague memories of this movie, for the music, but also it being like this sort of, you know, hot erotic thriller sort of movie. So, but I hadn't thought about it since ever. So it was fun to go back to it. Although I was like, oh, I thought in my head, I imagined this movie to be a lot sexier and hotter for some reason, but it wasn't. I'm like, I was like, where is all the nudity in this movie?
Oh, there wasn't nudity, but I actually was like surprised in how hot and sexy this movie was. I didn't remember it being this sexy, I guess is the word for it. And maybe this is something else too that's kind of been in the zeitgeist a lot, of how movies are completely sexless now. And, you know, there's this comparison around to dry movies and wet movies. And I think there's no wet movies made anymore. And it just was surprising, like in that mindset now, going back and watching this, because I've seen it every couple of years, but I haven't seen it probably in like 2 years all the way through. And I was like, wow, this movie is so like charged. And a lot of that has to do with the music, I will say. Like a lot of the scenes are really elevated by the use of the songs. There's that great Sneaker Pimp Six Underground song during their initial kind of like tryst back at her apartment. That really just adds to the scene, but then also makes the song cool, which I think is something else that one of the reasons why I chose this film is it makes the music cool because of what's happening, at least for me. And maybe this is just
me. It's
cheesy cool.
Yeah. But it's cool. And also, I think the word you're looking for is moist, not wet.
Should we put a warning in front of the episode if we're using that word? I know a lot of people don't like that word. So, I mean, they place a content warning on this episode. But yeah, so again, for me, it was around this movie has, it's cheesy cool. But, you know, as a kid, when I was a teenager, I thought it was cool. Like gangsters in all black with their little cane, Eastern European gangsters.
You wanted to be Val.
Well, I wanted actually to be the Russian guys. I thought Val was awesome, cool too. But like these Russian guys driving around their black Range Rovers, like looking so cool, listening to like this, you know, industrial techno really loud in their car. I'm like, oh, that's such cool music. These guys are so cool. And then I have to go out and get the soundtrack. And then I'm listening to, you know, Chemical Brothers and stuff and, you know, Moby, that really cool Moby track that plays. And I'm like, I'm cool. Like
really
those guys.
Moby track.
but yeah, it's like the coolness of the movie bleeds into the soundtrack. And then I get the soundtrack, and now there's all these tracks on there that are barely used in the movie too, which is something that I think is an art of soundtracks as well. Like they all capture the theme of the movie and the tone of it, but not every song is, you know, a whole sequence in the film. Sometimes you just hear it in the background for like 5 minutes.
Right.
But it's there on the soundtrack. And then that got me into all this, you know, Daft Punk was on there. I never heard of them before I listened to this. Again, Chemical Brothers. So this really ignited a whole love of an entire genre of music for me. And it was due to, those Eastern European gangsters and Val Kilmer.
Goodness. That's aged well.
I mean, the movie's incredibly dated, not only in like the fact, again, that it's wet/moist, which movies aren't anymore. The movie itself, which, again, I'm not going to defend it, even though I love it. It takes itself like very seriously, even though it's very dumb. And I think that was something in the 90s with some of these thrillers, more like adult-tinged thrillers, where they were trying to elevate it, but the material wasn't elevated. Everything else was. Like, Philip Noyce is a great director. All the actors are acting like they're in some, you know, highfalutin international spy drama. But the plot is absolutely ridiculous. The sequences are ridiculous. The whole second act is them just running from room to room and nothing's going on. I was like, nothing's happening.
Many things that are just completely unanswered questions of like how and why, like like the other Russian woman with the beret. I'm like, why are you here? What are you doing? Where did you come from? You haven't been here the whole time.
Yeah.
Just so many things that happen in the third act that make absolutely no sense.
Oh, totally.
But, you know, you're totally right. Like I don't know. I'm maybe because we are 90s kids, I'm nostalgic for this genre of like elevated, dumb, big budget kind of thriller movie, which is, you know, world globetrotting passport movie with, you know, people that look beautiful and cool. Like that's gone.
Right. It is.
You know, it was fun to go back and visit it just for those reasons. I will say, though, Elizabeth Shue is like the most ridiculous performance.
Val is good.
I don't know. It's like something about the smiling face. I'm like, why are you smiling the whole time? And also, like, the screenplay is just
it's not
hilarious.
It's silly. No. It's so silly.
She's like, we've been in trouble with your mafia. Like, who says that?
I know. Look, I think this is, I love Elizabeth Shue in this movie. I think she's never looked this good.
She looks amazing.
The performance is kind of silly. She's trying to like play this sort of Catholic schoolgirl because that's sort of his psychology, because that girl died in the beginning of the movie that he was in love with, but then trying to be innocent, but she has to be smart at the same time, but then socially awkward. I don't know if it really totally works. And you can tell that Val also thinks he's in some very like, you know, important movie that he's not really in, trying all these different voices and mannerisms.
And wigs. I love the wig factory.
It's so great. It's
like, what are you going to be putting on now?
I know. And I'm a huge Val Kilmer fan too. And this, yeah, you know, all, especially at this time when I was a kid, it was like The Doors and Ghosts in the Darkness and Heat and all these movies coming out. He's like so cool. And Batman Forever. Like he's Batman now. And what is he going to do? So that was another reason why, like, anything in this movie was cool to me, including the music, again, that I never would have really gravitated towards, just to bring it back to the, you know, the music a little bit here. But I listen to the soundtrack still more. I've listened to the soundtrack way more than I've seen the movie the time. It's like a good thing to throw in the background to do work or just to kind of, zone. There's against like nice house sort of trance stuff on here to kind of relax a little bit. But yeah, I had to throw this on the list. And it was fun, to rewatch it.
I will say, though, like you were saying, it's a great intro to that genre of music, which I love as well. And, you know, I was trying to think about Chemical Brothers and Daft Punk and think about how did I get onto them, and I couldn't remember. But I'm guessing this movie and movies of this time had a role to play in it. But the music isn't used that much in the movie. It's so far pushed in the background that there were times I'm like, is this the score or the soundtrack? Because it's just, you get like glimpses of the music, so it's not really using the music in any particular way other than the cheesy cool part that, you know, we talked about.
Right, and I think that again is where in the 90s this happened a lot, where there'd be a couple tracks in there, like the Sneaker Pimp song I remember back at the time was huge, that Six Underground song. That was the one that really popped, and that is a scene where it's definitely used in the movie,
right?
But all the rest of these tracks really aren't, and it's not a movie where the music is necessarily trying to add a lot to it. But it gets you interested enough, at least for me, to then go off and buy the soundtrack. And then that's where you listen to the whole thing and it explores a particular type of music. And I think this was, again, was something that was done a lot.
Like, you know, merchandising thing.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. It was music from and inspired by. That was a whole category of soundtracks that were huge in the 90s, like Mission Impossible 2, Blade, The Matrix. You know, these were giant. Batman Forever even was a huge soundtrack based on, you know, one song that was barely in the movie. But it was a whole genre that I really appreciated. And there's a lot of skill to putting those things together, even if it's not used in the movie. All those songs do capture something about what the film does. Oh, and just one more note just on the film to defend it a little bit. There were a massive amount of like reshoots and changes to the third act of the movie. There was a whole sequence of cut. She was originally supposed to die. He was supposed to come back, and the big turns into a revenge thing in the third act. And they pulled it after some test screenings. So that's why when you see it, it's sort of
it
makes no sense. It sort of ends abruptly. There's so many plot threads that don't ever get tied up. So I think there was there's a different version, at least, whether it's better or not, who knows? There's a different version of this movie that does exist out there somewhere. Even in the trailer, you can see a bunch of those scenes. Since they filmed whole sequences that they totally excised. If you like cheesy 90s, you know, thriller spy movies, I definitely recommend it. It's one of Val Kilmer's, I think, best as a movie star movies. It's just a representation of what he was trying to do, at least, as an actor. Though, again, I'm not going to defend this movie as a movie, but great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack.
Okay, so why don't we move to track number two? What is your number three movie that shaped your love of soundtracks?
All right, my number three is Marie Antoinette from 2006, directed by Sofia Coppola, starring Kirsten Dunst, Jason Schwartzman, Rip Torn, Steve Coogan, Judy Davis, a whole bunch of other people. Quick log line, the retelling of France's iconic but ill-fated queen Marie Antoinette, from a marriage to Louis the 17th at 14 to her reign as queen at 19 and to the end of her reign as queen. So I put this movie on my list because to me, this soundtrack sort of underlines the character's inner feelings and mood. That's what always has jumped out to me about this. And I think what Sophia does here is very interesting. And, you know, this soundtrack was a big topic of conversation that, oh, why is there like a new wavy, you know, post-punk soundtrack in this period drama and makes no sense. And I don't know, to me, it always made a lot of sense because it was sort of showing us that these people lived no matter how long ago and no matter what kind of lives they lived, at the core of it, they're still humans, you know? She's just a girl who is flawed but also has her own pleasures and guilty pleasures, and you're sort of getting a window into her mindset. But I think what's even more interesting and was more interesting to me back then even was the juxtaposition of the classical music that is used in a very ceremonious way. So all the ceremonies that are kind of, you know, preordained, whether it's you waking up in the morning and getting ready montage and what have you, the performances that happen that are musical in the movie, they are all classical music, even though a lot of it is original classical music. But then her inner thoughts and feelings and moods as Marie Antoinette, they are all underscored by modern music. So I don't know. I always found that juxtaposition so cool and kind of seamless. I think this movie becomes contemporary. It becomes a lot more relatable. It's a movie that I never think of as a period drama because of the music. I don't know why. Part of it also because the way it's shot. You kind of feel like these people live in Versailles. Like, you know, every single period drama movie, you know, as much as I love them, they are precious in a way, right? Like with the clothes, and you're getting like a bird's eye view, kind of view into their lives. But before I keep going further, had you watched this movie before? And if so, what did you think of it and the soundtrack?
Yeah, so I'd seen it when it came out didn't like it for a lot of the reasons, because actually I didn't think the soundtrack worked at all when I saw it, and just was like, why are we trying to feel empathetic towards Marie Antoinette? Like, I just couldn't get past that. And actually, I'd been wanting to, because for some reason, this has come up in the zeitgeist, at least online in the last like 3 or 4 years, people are talking about it a lot more and sort of like reappraising it, because it didn't do that well either, if I recall at the time. So I'd wanted actually to rewatch it. And I'm glad like now I had an excuse for this podcast to put it on. And I will say that I understood more the artistic intentions better, and did get to the point where, yes, I do have empathy for Marie Antoinette as a human. Not that I am upset by what happened to her, because that, you know, the history has to run its course. But that worked for me a little bit more. The music did sometimes, but it was odd. Like, I found myself being more engrossed in the movie during the scenes where they use the classical music instead of the modern thing. The movie in my mind was, I appreciate the movie more than I dismissed it at the time, I will say. I mean, that was, you know, it came out almost 20 years ago. I definitely dismissed it at the time as like, oh, this is a giant like creative mistake, because I didn't understand it. I now understand what Sophia was doing. Parts of it worked better for me, but I appreciate it more for what she was trying to do than the execution at least worked on me. I mean, the sequence that worked the best for me was the sequence where they're at the masquerade ball and you're hearing the contemporary, or not contemporary music, the 80s music. Because that feels like, oh, this could be sort of happening now. Like, you can have a masquerade ball now where they'd be playing, I can't remember what that track was, you know, some New Order song or what have you, in a ball that was happening in 2007. And that definitely made me feel like I could have been in any sort of teen high school drama. That really worked. But some of the other stuff for me, I don't know, it didn't really connect. But I'm very glad I watched this again. Like, again, my appreciation for the film is much more now than it was.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I don't know. For me, it always worked. Like, the Isle of Candy kind of macaroon, pink, drenched in pink champagne,
that was cool.
Montage.
Yeah.
So cool. It always that is really worked cool. on. Yeah. Whenever I think of this movie, whenever I eat a macaroon, I think about that song.
Yeah. That sequence is fantastic. Yeah. Very, fantastic, very well done. Right? Yeah. The colors, the way that it's shot, the music.
All of
totally,
it.
Totally.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's the thing, right? And at least this will come through my movies, is that the way the film is shot, I think is intricately linked with the music choices. Like, if this movie was shot in like a, you know, pristine kind of distanced, precious kind of way, the music would be too jarring. I think the reason it works is because it feels very handheld and intimate. You're in there, the colors pop, and it feels contemporary because of that, because you feel like you're living with these people.
Right.
I also love the whole montage of, and I forget what song it is, but it's a modern kind of new wavy song when it's a birthday and they stay up late to watch the sunrise.
Oh, yeah, and then yeah.
Walk around after that. Like, it's such a, you know, human thing to do. Like, this is somebody who obviously has a lot of wealth and access, but is very lonely and has all these pressures put on her. And her husband is kind of on a different planet. They don't really have a connection up to that point. So all she has is this gaggle of friends who aren't even friends, really.
Right.
And you sort of get this, that song to me strikes this balance of some sort of support, but there's also loneliness and melancholy.
Oh, yeah.
That, oh yeah, we had fun, we drank a bunch, we've woken up, now what?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And that sort of a feeling that is just so universal, has always been around, will always be around. And I think that's what she gets at with the music, which humanizes her, you know, no matter how flawed she might be, but it humanizes her. So, and then on a musical level, you know, this movie introduced me to kind of post-punk and then punk music. I don't think I'd really cared for classical music per se either. I couldn't remember. Maybe there were movies that got me interested in that, but this was a big one that kind of got me into just paying attention. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, no, I think, which actually too, maybe another reason why the film, or at least the music, doesn't work that well. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the post-punk new wave scene anyway. Like, that's music that never really spoke to me. So I think that made it a little harder potentially for me to get into the film. But I think you're right in terms of how it does, humanizes her and really makes you think. And this is something that came through more to me in this watch than the original one. It's like these people, meaning the royals in France at least, and maybe royals in other places too, they're also caught up in this system. Like, they're not representative of it. They're not really in charge of anything. It's like the machinations of a monarchy are sort of even bigger than even the king and queen are. They're caught up in this too. Like, they don't have opinions or politics or much of anything. They're just going along for the ride, much like a peasant would also be stuck in that system, or a lord for a certain extent too, potentially. And that it's the system itself that she's a victim of. And she just caught up in the fact that, like, hey, we have to throw out this system because it's not working anymore. And okay, well, you're part of that system, so you have to go too. So it is like, okay, that's, you know, sad on a certain level because this is a human being that has to get chucked out. But I guess I felt a lot more empathy for her in this time of just, again, being caught up in something that she doesn't even really want to be in.
No,
it's not giving
I'm
her
so
pleasure.
Young.
Right. She's sent off to another country basically as a political move to make, Austria and France get closer together. Like, she has no love for this other guy or really even desire to live this life. Like, she's trapped too. And that's, I think, the loneliness comes across as well in those scenes with the music too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a gorgeous film. That's the other thing of, like, I hadn't seen it in years now, but just to watch it, you know, in its full color glory, it's just such a fun experience. My only little note about this movie is that I think it can be a little faster. There are definitely moments in the middle or what have you where it drags a little bit. But other than that, I think this is one of her best, I would say. And also a great Kirsten Dunst performance. She looks incredible and is able to kind of straddle that line of somebody who's, you know, relishing all this, but is also a victim of it, is also very lonely, but is trying to compensate for that loneliness with more enjoyment. Again, very human things,
right?
You know, she's able to strike all of that. And it's not a theatrical movie at all. Like, a lot of period dramas have, you know, big monologues and a lot of precious scene stealing kind of, you know, acting. It's not at all. Like, it's so low key, her acting. There's no accent work either. Like, she just speaks the way she does, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's quite brilliant.
Yeah, no, that's a good shout out to her. I do think the movie sort of lives or dies on that performance, because that's, to your point about it being a little slow, there isn't really much going on in most of the movie other than just sort of like a cinema verite look at her life
True.
And what she does. And there's, the plot is there isn't really much of one. They don't actually deal a lot with the politics that are going on that lead to, you know, the king and queen having to flee and then getting deposed. Because that's probably, she wasn't necessarily involved in that. Again, that was like the system and things beyond, you know, her and Louis. Well, necessarily not beyond Louis' control. I think he could have done some things differently to protect the monarchy. He definitely made some mistakes. But her performance was great, and that made me appreciate a lot more. And two, like, Sophia's directing, I think, the movie, though she's always had a very good eye, even dating back to like Virgin Suicides and Lost in Translation, like she's very good at, you know, the visuals. And but this movie, I think, is something else. So yeah, I'm glad I saw it again. I have a more appreciation for it now.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. All right, what is your next?
So to move from Versailles to Chicago, my number two is The Blues Brothers from 1980. And this is directed by John Landis, starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. And the IMDb plot summary, Jake Blues rejoins his brother Elwood after being released from prison. But the duo has just days to reunite their old R&B band and save the Catholic home where the two were raised, outrunning the police as they tear through Chicago. This movie is on my list because while I was a fan and grew up around the music that this movie features, you know, my parents, especially my mom, listening to a lot of 60s R&B soul music. So I knew who like Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and James Brown were. And I'd listened to the music, but this movie, because they're all in it, brought to life these stars where I'd only really had a relationship with them through, you know, an album cover and then listening to their music. This brings to life this music that I loved and got me in even more into this type of music and just an appreciation for it. And it's one of my, again, soundtracks I listen to all the time. One of my favorite movies too. So just start off with a question for you. Had you seen this film before?
I had not seen this movie before.
Oh, really?
I obviously always knew of it, and I knew, you know, Aretha's famous scene in the diner and with the song and all of that, and I love R&B music and soul music and such, but I'd never seen it.
Oh.
So it was fun to check it out. And two back-to-back John Landis movies after Trading Places from our last episode on Money.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, John Landis definitely, for me, like his movies shaped a lot of other perennial. I mean, this movie is going to be on my top five movies I've seen the most in my life. Like I would always be on, growing up, would always be Blues Brothers all the time. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. Could have been, you know, talked about in the comedy episode that we had last year as well. But yeah, so like for me, it was bringing to life these music stars. And also I sort of felt in the way that they were doing it where, you know, Jake and Elwood, you know, Aykroyd and Belushi, they were sort of giving a spotlight to these stars to actually come and then perform their own music. Yes, they're not like a tribute band, though they do play, you know, obviously R&B music. They didn't write their own music. They were a band that existed to do covers. But the way that they have reverence and the way that these stars are treated in this movie, where they come on and it's very clear these are important giant legends that are, you know, you're sort of in honor to be in a scene with, that I felt a lot in the similar way with like Jake and Elwood, just sort of sitting back and watching them perform. There's so many great scenes, and then just kind of, you see them in the background just sitting there watching like Aretha at the diner, which is, I think, the highlight of the movie for me. That scene is just so incredible. She just blows the doors off, even better than the original recording of that song, in my opinion, from the 60s is her version in this film. And you just see them kind of be back there just like, whoa, like she's killing it. And that's how I feel too. Like when I'm watching some of these, you know, these old legends like Aretha and Ray Charles and, you know, John Lee Hooker and the whole Cab Calloway scene at the end too, which I was someone I hadn't actually heard of before. Mm-hmm. And he was a giant, you know, force in music back in the day and in film too. So it was great to see that, you know, be introduced to me as well, you know, and not only the music that is in the movie in terms of the performances, but even the music that just played like in the background, the tracks that they have on during the, you know, the car chases got me into a lot more music. Sam and Dave, they were listening to a lot. I got into them through this film, big, you know, soul duo. So I think that both the in film and the out of film music that they use is brilliant, because all those tracks aren't on the soundtrack. Like you listen to the soundtrack, it's all the performances from the movie. They don't have the songs that they play, you know, during the film, which also I think work really well too. And the driving sequences, especially, I think this is a great, you know, the Peter Gunn theme is great just for putting it on. Sometimes I'm in the car, I'm like, I got
to
throw that on when I'm driving. And obviously all those incredible car chases through the mall, the big chase at the end, the music works so well. And in terms of the film, like, again, I've praised it a lot. These, I just think that, you know, they're two dirtbags who don't really, I mean, I guess they kind of get redemption because they do give the money to the church at the end, but they don't, they're not good people. And the movie's not trying to pretend that they are. They treat everyone kind of like crap, except for their band, or not even their band. Actually, they don't treat very well either. Just each other, right? There's a love that they have for each other and the music. And those are really the two things that matter to them, and everything else they could, you know, they could take it or leave it, which I think is, not the best qualities to have, but at least, again, the movie doesn't try to say these people are good people. I mean, they get thrown in prison at the end, is the end of the movie. Right. They pay for all their crimes, but they are doing a good deed. And the love of music of these two characters definitely comes through, which is, you know, I also love the music as much as they do. So it's always fun to watch them in this performance.
Yeah, no, it was really fun to check it out. And the music is amazing. The music is the star. And I love how you put it that the movie knows that the characters, the lead characters know that too, that they're in the reverence and the glow of these great artists.
Mm-hmm.
My only thing was that this movie needs to be like three times faster than it is, which I think it's sort of hard to drop into a movie like this that you haven't seen and you haven't grown up with, especially after watching something like Trading Places, which is just so, you know, magnetically paced.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is not that. And maybe that's the point. You're supposed to luxuriate in the music and, you know, every star that you're going to meet and what have you. But at the same time, from a plot standpoint and the fact that this is, you know, a comedy and a movie about these two oddball people, I don't know. I somehow expected this movie to be a lot faster. Instead, you sort of sit with these people. So that was my only thing that I found myself tuning out. But then I was pulled back in by the music, you know, every time I kind of wandered off.
Yeah, I mean, Landis
feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, Landis definitely has a slower pace. Just, I mean, even Animal House and Coming to America, these aren't like very, very fast comedies.
But they feel appropriate. I don't know. This one felt a lot slower to me for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, it's a road trip movie, and those also can be a little like, you know, there's not, the plot is just, you know, getting to a show, which I also love those types of movies too. Though I like this movie because the show happens at the end of the second act. It's a whole third act where they have to do the, you know, a giant car chase. So typically that's the big finale, right? When the performance, but I definitely can see you on the slowness factor. Yeah. Cause you're sort of, I think they wanted you to kind of sit back and like take in kind of what's going on. There is actually a longer cut. There's a director's cut that's like 20 to 30 minutes longer that I think is way too slow. Like not the one I would definitely track down the theatrical cut. Maybe you stumbled upon the wrong version too.
No, I watched the theatrical one.
Okay, good. Yeah. It just adds so much padding to the movie that I don't think needs to be there. But I get what you mean. It's definitely a very, it's got one gear, I think, and it just kind of goes that gear through the, I guess a couple big moments, like the big performance at the hall. And then again, Aretha Franklin's Think, I think is definitely a highlight, but yeah, it doesn't really kick into a higher gear, even though there's like 1,000 crazy car chases and car crashes in it. But I get what you're saying about up at the pace for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But super fun. But yeah, the Aretha scene is the showcase of the movie. And
I think so too.
I kept thinking, I wish she had done more of film acting. I haven't seen her do anything else. Maybe she has, but yeah.
She's in this, there was a terrible sequel to this movie that she was in, but actually I remember reading that she struggled a lot with that scene because she had to lip sync to her own track, and she sort of improvises every time she sings. So it was a huge struggle for her to do that because she can't, like, I don't know if it's not faking the performance, but it's like lip syncing to herself. She had a lot of problems with it. So maybe that's something where she's like, I don't want to have to deal with this. I just like singing live and singing in a recording booth. Like, this is not something, I don't want to go down the Diana Ross path of becoming an actress, but she does a great job in this movie. Again, that scene is just so, so great. So great.
So great.
But cool. Glad you finally saw this movie.
Me too.
Okay, well, let's switch back over to your mixtape. What do we got number two for you?
All right. So my number two is a little known film called The Goodfellas from 1990, directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, Ray Liotta, Lauren Bracco. Quick logline on the movie: the story of Henry Hill and his life in the mob, covering his relationship with his wife, Karen Hill, and his mob partners, Jimmy Conway, Tommy DeVito in the Italian American crime syndicate. Okay, so I put this list movie on my list because this movie, to me, underlines the period spanning over decades, and is sort of the heartbeat and the motion to its characters throughout the movie. You grow up and you live and die with these people because of this music. But before I go further, I'm sure you've watched this movie before. But
never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
No, up and comer.
Yeah, some director I never heard of. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know what this movie is. No, yeah, this is one of the best movies ever made. Yep. And one of the best soundtracks. So those are that's my high level thoughts.
Yep, exactly. I mean, what more to even say? And the fact that it's a number two, I mean, means it's sort of ridiculous because it's some in the context of our personal lives and, you know, when we come to these movies. But this is obviously a masterclass in filmmaking, a masterclass in putting together a soundtrack. So how many times have you watched this movie, I guess, is the better question.
Oh, maybe half a dozen times, 10 times, something like that over the course of my life so far. It's it's a long watch and it's not something you just kind of can throw on, though it is a fun movie. I think it's got a lot of zip and bang to it. A lot of it is due to the soundtrack. And, you know, I'm glad we're putting Marty on one of these lists because I think there's very few or there are certain directors that are just impeccable at picking the right songs for the right scenes. And he's in that short list for me. Like, he can put together a soundtrack like few other directors can. And this is, I think, his masterwork in that, too, to be honest.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I think I've watched it about half a dozen times as well. You're right. I don't think about putting this movie on, but when I do put it on, there's no way you could put it off, though.
No, you can't put it down.
Totally swept up in this movie by its pacing, its music, its sense of place, performances. Like, it's a total masterclass, like we've been saying. And yeah, I agree. Like, I think we have a PTA or a Wes Anderson or a Tarantino, who I think in my mind are also, you know, up there on that list of assembling amazing soundtracks. It's because of this,
yeah,
I think.
I agree. And actually, this week I just watched Marty Scorsese's first movie. I'd never seen it before. Oh. And he uses music in the same way. A lot of drops from the time the setting. I'm like, wow, like he could do this even his first film, like back in 68, and he's still doing it like 20 years later, even better. I mean, this might be the best film soundtrack, I think, of all time. There's no score in the entire movie. It's all just these songs. And they're used so well in this film.
So well. And it's sort of a time-spanning, decade-spanning kind of, you know, curation, which I think is so incredible. So personally for me, like the fact that I got into music from the 50s and 60s and 70s, so people like Tony Bennett, Aretha, we mentioned, the Stones, Ronettes, all these people, I know them because of this movie. This movie introduced me to all these people, which is amazing. But, you know, on this watch, I think I kept thinking that, why do I root for these people? Why am I invested in these people? They're not good people. They're doing bad things. But you root in their ambition. You root in their troubles and such. And I think, apart from the masterclass filmmaking like we talked on about, I think it is the music. There's something about the music that kind of puts you in their lives. You're, like I said earlier, you're growing up with them, which automatically humanizes them, and you have empathy for them because you're sort of, you know, part of the fabric of their lives. And what better way to weave a fabric of someone's life than music? So I think it's such a key part to it. Like, you remove the music from this film, I think this movie becomes a hard watch. And I don't think you root for these people.
Right. It's like the songs you love. And, you know, I don't have nostalgia for the songs in the sense of I grew up when they were on or when they were released, but I listened to all this music growing up. Like, my parents had this exact, like, this was sort of a soundtrack that, not the soundtrack, but these types of, you know, songs you know, 60s, 50s, 60s was all the music I was listening to as a kid. So I have a nostalgia for it in that point. But so you have a connection to the music, and then you hear the music over scenes where these characters, even sometimes they're doing terrible things, but you have then some kind of connection to them through the music, and you empathize with them, and not empathize with them. You, you like care about them in some way. It's weird.
Yeah.
Cause yeah, they are, none of these people are redeemable, I feel like, in this movie. Yeah. But you care about them. You want him to get away at the end. When they have that incredible scene where the jump into the fire track is playing and there's the helicopter there and he's all paranoid and like driving around. It's the music helps you be paranoid along with him because of that track playing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you just made me think of this right now, which is that if a movie were made about us, for example, mm-hmm. and a master director like Scorsese, I mean, not saying that would ever happen.
You never know. He could make the movie version of this podcast directed by Martin Scorsese.
It would be a short film, I think.
okay.
but I think that movie will have the songs and the music that represent the times that we grew up in and the music that, you know, underscore our lives. And mm-hmm. in that, once again, I think it humanizes them because people have been people. You know, there's something about the connectivity to music through those times that all these people were living and doing the things that they were doing, good, bad, or ugly. And I think there's something about that. Like, that is, once again, Taylor's oldest time. It'll keep happening. We'll keep doing things and there'll always be music playing, literally or metaphorically, to underscore whatever is happening in that time. And I think that's what's kind of universal about it.
No, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and not only for me, especially on this rewatch, because maybe it's been like 4 years since I'd seen the film. Mm-hmm. The characters, but also the craft of the filmmaking itself. You know, one of my favorite sequences in any film is when Ray Liotta takes the girl through the kitchen into the club.
Oh,
and there's that one of my favorite songs, actually, And He Kissed Me by the Crystals. And it's sort of him, and the song kind of does this too. It's like he's wooing her and you can see why she's falling for him. But I'm also then just wooed by the technical craft of that shot. And it's almost like I'm, as an audience member, falling in love with the craft of this movie because the song, which I also really love, is over this shot that is just one of the most incredible sequences. I mean, even thinking about it just gives me chills, like how amazing that is. And the music's a big part of it. Like, that if there wasn't for that track playing while he's wooing her through the kitchen into the club and sitting down at the table, and it just wouldn't have the same effect, I think.
Totally.
And Marty knows that, you know,
he knows that. And it's so critical because, you know, you ask these questions, why is she there? Why does she put up with this? Because guess what? She, A, loves him, is deeply attracted to him.
Yeah.
Is also seduced by this whole world. And I think that sequence does that. And that's the thing. Like, every song is chosen so perfectly that you're put in the state of mind of the characters, and that's why you live through them. Like, mm-hmm. when he's a kid and the song is playing from the very beginning, when he's like, I always wanted to be a mob guy.
Yeah.
And you sort of are like, yeah, I get it, because that world of power and is so seductive based on, you know, his own circumstance and his own family life, having that, you know, level of control where other kids and other girls are watching him just drive around, you know, expensive cars up and down, and the music is playing in the background. Like, it all is seamless, and you're transported, you know, in that time and in the minds of these people. It's just so brilliant. The other thing that struck me this time was Karen and their relationship, which is such a critical part to this movie. And she's mm-hmm. almost like, you know, she's a co-lead.
I
always think of this movie with Joe Pesci and De Niro, obviously Ray Liotta. I don't think I'd thought of it from Karen's point of view a lot until this watch. Like, the voiceover switches to her.
That's a crazy moment in the movie too. It's like, whoa, like, it's jarring at first. And then you realize, oh no, it's like, it's their story.
It's their story.
They're coming at it from different sides. Like, she's being brought into this world, he's being seduced by it, but they are co-leads for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in the end, like, the whole last act of him, like, cooked up in the car and
it's crazy.
The pasta and all the things. Oh my gosh. Like, unbelievable.
It's so great. Yeah. And I love too, just getting to the music a little bit, his use of Derek and the Dominoes as Layla in here, which, you know, that's a song that's got one of the most famous guitar riffs of all time, but he doesn't use it. He cuts right into the the amazing piano crescendo at the end, when mm-hmm. also like things are kind of, you know, they're going, there's a sequence where they're showing all the dead bodies. So it's mm-hmm. like chickens are coming home to roost. It's a big crescendo of what's going on. And to take that part of that song, which is one of the best songs ever written, and take the part that's maybe a little less noticeable to most folks, but it's this big epic ending of the song. And this is the big epic conclusion to this heist that they pulled, and showing the all the people that are getting knocked off by it. It's just, again, one of the best, I think, needle drops in any movie. If I were to make a top 10, that one would be for sure in there. I mean, it makes, that's the sequence I think of after the and then he kissed me sequence. It's that one,
right.
Which, to the movie's credit and to the reason why we're talking about it in this episode, it's both because of the songs and the montages that they're, or the sequences, I should say, that they're creating with the songs with them. Like, those are the memorable moments in this movie to me. That, and I guess also the jump into the fire sequence when there's the helicopters and he's panicking and he's on the coke and he's getting, all of the music is intertwined with every single one of those scenes, and it elevates it. It's just such an incredible use of a music soundtrack.
Totally. I mean, it almost feels like the story, the screenplay, the performances, the way it's shot, the music, like, all came out together, blaring, you know, like a giant rainbow from a cannon. Like, that's the visual I have in my mind. Like, it wasn't written after or before. Like, it's all so seamlessly just intertwined as the fabric of the whole thing. So now what more can we say?
It's so if anyone hasn't seen this movie, like, you definitely gotta check it out. It's one of the best. I think it's Scorsese's best.
I agree.
And the soundtrack is just incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is the reason why Scorsese is Scorsese.
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it just he this is the movie he's hitting it on all cylinders. Awesome. And again, it was shocking to me to go back to his first movie that was, 20, 30 years before this. And he's still doing these needle drops of music. At that time, it was more contemporary because it was from the late 60s. But I was like, wow, he was even doing this then. I mean, there's a whole sequence in that film with The Doors is the End that I'm like, whoa, like, he had it even then. Like, this is just something that's always been a talent of his. But I think Goodfellas is where it hits its peak. It's definitely the crescendo of that. It's just an incredible film.
Yeah. All right. What is your next?
So my number one film that shaped my love of film soundtracks is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou from the year 2000. Written and directed by the Coen brothers, starring George Clooney, John Turturro, Tim Blake Nelson, and John Goodman. And the plot summary: in the deep South during the 1930s, three escaped convicts search for hidden treasure while a relentless lawman pursues them. So this movie is on my list, actually, in a similar ways to Goodfellas. I think the music makes this movie work. The music is just as much part of the mise-en-scene, which is, you know, a term to mean, you know, the production design, the camera work, the lighting, as those other things, like the visuals. It's really the soundtrack to me that completes that picture. And the movie set, like it mentioned in the summary, during the 30s, during the Depression, and all these songs, while only one of them I think is an original recording, they're all songs of that time that do transport you back into that place and time. As well, comment on the movie as it goes along. But just before I get into it a little more, have you seen the film, listened to the soundtrack? What is your history with Oh Brother?
Yeah. I had not watched this movie, which is kind of embarrassing to admit. I think the Coens, obviously, they are incredible geniuses. I admire them, but the film bros are going to get mad at me. But I haven't seeked out their work, you know, for whatever reason. But then, of course, when I watch it, I'm completely blown away. But it's not something I think about. So I don't know. There's something about the movie and Clooney, you know, covered up in dirt when he's totally handsome, and all of it just was like a barrier for me to watch this movie. But I'm so glad I watched it, because yet again, it's a masterpiece. Of course it is. It's it's them.
I mean, they're probably my top five favorite directors of all time, and this is actually my favorite movie of theirs. I mean, arguably there's ones that I might be quote unquote better, but this is my personal favorite of their movie. And again, a lot of it has to do with the soundtrack. I mean, at the time when this came out, I don't know if it was similar in India too, but the soundtrack was a total phenomenon. You know, one Grammy album of the year. It still is in
like the top 10 soundtracks on iTunes at least.
Yeah.
It always is.
Yeah, it was a huge hit. And I also, it was unlike, you know, The Saint, where I mentioned like it helped me get into electronica music. I always had liked this old timey Americana folk music. Now, yeah. I hadn't heard of these songs and artists per se, but I like this type of music.
I do too.
And it was a nice kind of encapsulation of that. So even on its own, you know, if you want to listen to a soundtrack or just a compilation of Americana, the soundtrack does that. But within the context of the film, I think it really does set the mood of the depression. And it's great hearing the juxtaposition of some of these songs, which are very, very positive. And, you know, okay, there's going to be a better tomorrow and, you know, things will get better. Because it was at the time, like you had to be telling yourself that because it looked like the whole world was ending. And the music, I think, was uplifting people at the time. And that's why a lot of the music was a bit positive, much like in this film, you know, even though there's a lot of darkness around them, you know, there's KKK involved kind of chasing them a little bit at a certain point. You know, you deal with death and obviously George Clooney's, you know, trying to get back to his wife who's scorned him. They're prisoners. So there's a lot of these dark themes, I guess you could say, but the movie is so light and cheerful. And the music kind of helps kind of push that, I think, up because it is such fun, kind of cheery music.
Yeah, music is great. And it's fun and cheery, but I think it like you said, it also has like a deep sense of melancholy to it. Because these people are going through some existential times, you know, like the other two, Totoro and
Tim Blake Nelson.
Exactly. Who are supposedly dim-witted, but at the end of the day, you know, they probably make better choices, even though they are, you know, simpler minded in a way, perhaps, versus Clooney represents kind of the modern age that, oh, I'm the contrarian. I'm not going to do the things that you guys are doing. But ultimately, he has to come to his senses and admit some of the things that are just beyond his control. And I don't think all of that lands or would land as well if it's not for the music. Like you have to be transported in this time, in this place, but it's also done in like a fun, cheery way. I mean, without the music, this is a very dark movie, or it could be. But to your point, like the music subverts all of that, engages you. So I had such a good time watching this movie. There's some laugh out loud moments. Performances are great. Beautifully shot, obviously.
Oh. The cinematography, which the first time they ever used like digital color correction, because they filmed the movie in the summer, so everything was green. And if you've seen the film, I mean, you haven't, I'm talking to listeners now. If you've seen the film, you know the whole thing is very sepia toned. Right. Everything's kind of yellows and golds, and that was all added in digitally. And there's the first time a cinematographer had ever done that. So credit to Deakins on that. Yeah. I also think Clooney's performance, this is the best use of what he is as a star. His sort of like goofy, a little arrogant, but it's kind of sweethearted arrogance, not mean. Yeah. He's kind of dumb, but he's also kind of charming. It's all mixed together in this character. And that is Clooney when he works in films. Like that's his persona, for better or for worse. And I think this is the best example of that for sure.
I would agree. Like after Ocean's 11, which is sort of my all-time Clooney, like it's basically harnessing everything Clooney has to offer, this might be the second.
But similar, I think it's Danny Ocean's character is similar-ish, and again, he's like kind of arrogant, but he's charming, but he's a crook, but at the same time you care
less
about
goofy.
Him. Okay, yeah, a little less. Yes, you're right, less goofy. Yeah, he doesn't have that cool the cool hair gel stuff, the Dapper Dan hair gel. I love that.
So good.
And his little like pencil mustache. He's so great in it.
He's vain and
I know, yeah, totally. Another thing as I was watching it for this too, just to think about, you know, another theme of this movie is also just the power of music. This is the dawn of recorded music, the dawn of the radio. There's a lot of plot elements in here that have to do with the fact that, you know, they record this song by they make up their band, Soggy Bottom Boys. They have Man of Constant Sorrow. It actually saves them at the end of the movie because everyone knows who they are because mass media is just starting and the power of radio. And I think that also is, you can read that as well as like, as an audience member, the power of the music that I'm experiencing also makes me love the movie and won't go out and buy the soundtrack. So I'm still being controlled, or not controlled, led on by the power of the music in the same way that the characters in the movie also are too, in a way, because they're tuning in to hear about Soggy Bottom Boys, and the politicians are trying to use music to get elected. And so it has a lot of those themes that are weaved into it too.
And religion too.
You're right. And it's religion. Exactly.
Always has been such a close pairing. I mean, that's the power of music, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And I think this movie touches on that, and even in a meta way, because the soundtrack is one of the highest selling of all time. Again, won the Grammy. Everyone was listening to it in 2000, and to your point, still does today. And another soundtrack that is on my, you know, top 10, top 15 soundtracks I listen to still all the time. I kind of throw it on if I want to be in a good mood, and then it makes me happy, and then I want to go watch the movie again, and then it's just like a vicious cycle. If I watch the movie, I listen to the soundtrack for a week, and then go back and watch the movie, and which actually, the Blues Brothers is like that too. Lesser extent, The Saint, I listen to the soundtrack, I don't necessarily have to go back to watch the movie.
Yeah.
But I think that's the power of a soundtrack. You can either stand on its own and love it, or, you know, one that makes you go right back into the movie and watch it again. This is definitely one of those for me. So I'm glad you checked it out. And I guess, you know, for listeners who don't know, the title of this movie comes from Sullivan's Travels, which is a film that we covered on our podcast last year, that I had actually never seen that movie before. And I always wanted to, because it was, you know, obviously alludes to this movie, because that was the movie they were trying to make within Sullivan's Travels. So I guess this is my gift back to you. I've seen this one, and your gift to me was seeing Sullivan's Travels, which I had not seen before and also really enjoyed too.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. That's such a great connection. And once again, speaks to the genius of the Coens to kind of pick that up and kind of go with it. That's pretty brilliant. The other thing I was going to say about this kind of music, which is how I feel about country music as well, that it's, at least to me, this is music in its purest form, because what is music? It is a form of storytelling. I always think of the origins of music of, you know, communities gathering together. Mm. And this sort of has that kind of very pure sense of, I'm going to tell you how I feel. I'm going to talk about what is going through my mind and in the place and the time that I live in. And it's going to be melodic and it's going to be fun. You're going to enjoy it. So I don't know. There's something very pure in that. Which I guess dovetails with the movie and the time period in its but that's what makes it timeless as well, I think.
Yeah, no, totally. I agree. That's why this movie, the you know, the Appalachian folk music or whatever you want to call it, you know, people still listen to it today. It still influences a lot of country artists and pop artists even today. Okay, so we've reached the final track now on our exploration down soundtrack. So what are we ending with today, Karan?
All right. So my number one is a movie called Manhattan, 1979, directed by Woody Allen, starring Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, Marielle Hemingway, Michael Murphy, a bunch of other folks. Quick log line on the movie. The life of a divorced television writer dating a teenage girl is further complicated when he falls in love with his best friend's mistress. So obviously, you know, PSA up front, this is a problematic film, always was, and it's even more problematic given all of Woody Allen's stuff. But I had to put this on my list because this movie, when I watched it, whenever I did, in my mind, there's no other soundtrack that underlines a place and its mood better. Gershwin's tune is now in sync with New York in my mind, will always be. Whenever I'm there, whenever I think about New York, this is what I hear in my head, and it's because of this movie. And this is also my intro to jazz, which is a genre of music that I've hadn't really heard of much of or cared for much. And through this movie, you know, Coltrane and everybody else that is now part of my regular daily, weekly listening, I owe it to this movie. So yeah, had you watched this movie before and its soundtrack?
Yeah. So just to remind the listeners again, I don't like Woody Allen movies. It's not necessarily anything to do with the problematic nature. I've just never really have. But there was a period back in college when I was like, you know, I just got to watch the big Woody Allen movies just as a film fan, even if I'm not going to enjoy it. So this, I had watched it once back then, and this is the second time that I've seen it.
What did you think this time?
This time I could appreciate it more. I think just to address it up front, I guess the nature of the plot is very hard to kind of get
very
over
hard.
The fact that not only is it a teenager, it's an underage teenager, which I think there is a legal difference for that. So that piece of it, there's a scene where they're in a carriage ride through like Central Park or something. And he says some line in sort of like caressing her way that literally it turned my stomach. Like I felt physically disgusted by what I was watching. But putting all that aside, what struck me this time was how gorgeous the movie is. Just the cinematography and the sequences, especially that opening sequence that you were referencing with Gershwin under it, is just so beautiful. The black and white cinematography, I think, is one of the best uses of it since color came in. That sequence and then the sequence when they're in the planetarium, which if you were to turn off everything that they were saying, because I'm not a fan of Woody Allen's dialogue, is one of the most beautiful scenes of a movie that I've seen. And those things, I guess, when I don't remember the visuals landing on me as much back when I first saw it. But to me, like the visuals were like, holy crap, just so gorgeous. But I think the fact that he's, you know, this is a love letter to Manhattan, a city that he loves. And it's very clear he loves Manhattan. The music, though, underscores that even more so. And if you were to remove the music from that opening scene of all those shots of New York, it would be like, oh, this is cool and it's nice, but you wouldn't feel that love that he's trying to express. You need the Gershwin song. And it's a brilliant use of that for sure.
I totally agree. And all across the film, right? Like the movie underscores the city, his love for it, and there's a sense of whimsy and melancholy throughout the movie, which is sort of what he is, at least in this movie. And that's underscored, you know, with the soundtrack. And you're right, like the visuals are stunning on their own, but they're elevated even more so because of the music, like that park bench scene when they're looking at the bridge. All of that is just amazing. But yeah, the movie is very problematic. Like I have not watched this movie in a very, very long time because of everything. And because this is like, you can't even separate art from reality in this movie because it's all there. And I'm like, oh, this is way too much. But there is something about the music and there's something about the cinematography that it sort of makes New York and these people feel like that they are in a, it's like a different planet. It's like a fictional planet that, and I'm not saying I'm okay, obviously, with what is represented in the movie. It's horrifying and stomach churning, like you said, but I don't know. There's something about those other elements that the movie breezes through. I don't know why. I think it's because of those elements. Like if you remove those elements, this movie would be totally unwatchable, I think, because of his themes.
No, I agree. I think he's clearly trying to make a love letter to a city that he loves, or a specific part of the city too, Manhattan versus the other parts of New York. And the music and the cinematography show that. And the plot elements of it are the problematic parts. But the theme of that piece of it, at least, I think, you know, you can still enjoy, and it definitely has an effect. I mean, again, I got physically sick when I saw him with that, with the, you know, Muriel Hemingway's character, but I was still enthralled by those other scenes. Just because of the power of what the movie can do, though. The ending, like, I don't, him running back to the, you know, the underage teenager as being some big romantic gesture at the end, kind of, I'm like, this is not, I didn't land on a good place, but no, it started off on a great one. I mean, again, that the Gershwin song and the shots of Manhattan are, you know, you just watch that on YouTube
and all of amazing. Him and Diane, which is all very good, even though that is also, you know, promiscuous in its own way, but at least these are contemporaries and I love their banter and how like different they are, but yet they are sort of cut from the same cloth and the filmmaking. And this is what Woody Allen is good at, right? Like just, I know you're not a fan of his dialogue, but I like that kind of way to get to know somebody. You kind of hate them, but you're still attracted to them. And you're all this complicatedness that's sort of, you know, unfolding in right in front of you, intellectual or pseudo-intellectual, like all of that. And it's pretty fun. But yeah, the Meryl Hemingway part, if only they just cast, I don't know, even a 25-year-old.
I was just going to say, why does she have to be a high schooler?
Exactly.
Just make her 25. I don't think it would have changed. You're still an old man going after a 25-year-old, but at least it's legal.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
All it would have taken.
I agree. Just change that, because I think you're right. Like, the Diane Keaton relationship that he has is really interesting and very adult and dealing with a lot of complicated things. It's complicated, but love is complicated. Like, that's fine. And, you know, a movie that I like less than this one, Annie Hall, their relationship and her character in that movie annoy the hell out of me. But in this one, I'm like, oh, like, this is kind of interesting. And, you know, I get her character. And if the movie was just kind of about that, did he need to pursue a high school student? Probably not. Could the high school student have been at least a college student? Just make him be in college. I just don't get why. I mean, I don't want to start psychoanalyzing Woody Allen to understand why that had to be part of the plot, but it definitely doesn't need to be. But look, I mean, again, I think this is still a good use of, getting back to the theme of the episode, it is a great use of how music can elevate these scenes, which already work on a certain level. But the Gershwin stuff especially, it's like, wow, it is same thing what you were saying. Like, I now, when I hear that song, it's immediately New York to me, and I tie it to a lot of the same images that he captured on this film. So I think it's a really good use of music.
Yeah. All right. Were there any movies that didn't make your list?
Yeah, there were. Goodfellas, but you took that one. So I had to, put a Marty movie on there, because again, I think he's a master of that. Rushmore, because I think Wes Anderson's another master of that. Kill Bill Volume 1, again, Quentin Tarantino, the other one I put on that short list. And then a couple other movies that helped me with my fall in love with electronic music, Run Lola Run and The Matrix. What about you?
Yeah, all very good choices. Yeah, I had also Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino. I had Licorice Pizza and Boogie Nights, PTA.
Oh man, yeah, that's a great soundtrack.
Great soundtrack. And then Royal Tannenbaums that we covered on the episode, because Wes Anderson is also incredible in this. And then, gosh, what is the Cameron Crowe movie?
Almost Famous?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, nice. Yeah, he's another one actually who, even though he's kind of fallen off the being a good director train, he's still very, very good at using songs in his films.
And that movie and that soundtrack is just incredible. And
agreed.
I almost put that, but yeah, that was a hard one to move out of the list. What's coming up next, Alex?
So we're moving from music to fashion. The episode in 2 weeks we have coming up
fashion.
Are movies that shaped our sense of style, which I'll admit I don't have a style, but, you know, I try, and we could talk about the movies that, have been my influence, at least.
Everybody has a sense of fashion.
That's true. I guess, sense of fashion, whether it's good or not, you know, thank God this is a podcast and not, you know, a video podcast, and people can see how terrible my fashion sense is. hopefully folks enjoyed today's episode. Got a lot of soundtracks to check out. I know it's difficult nowadays actually tracking down some of these soundtracks on streaming services. If you can't find them there, you know, a lot of Amazon has used soundtracks for like a dollar, so you can probably track them down there. A lot of the stuff we listened to today, but hopefully you enjoyed this musical journey we went on. If you like the episode and aren't currently subscribing, make sure you subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. We also have a YouTube channel, so check us out there too. You can subscribe on YouTube as well, and we'll see you in 2 weeks for fashion.
Let them eat cake. Until then.